According to Albert Einstein, the only source of knowledge is experience. So let's ask Dr. Rob. Hello and welcome to this week's Urgent Bite, brought to you by the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. My name is Guy Melrose, and today we're going to have a chat with Dr. Rob Everson. So I'm joined here by Dr. Rob Everson, who is an urgent care fellow, originally from Canada. Rob's been in medical practice for 34 years now, having spent 12 years in rural British Columbia working in ED type environment and rural practice there. He moved to New Zealand 17 years ago, and for the last 10 years or so has been working in urgent care under the Urgent Care College and is a fellow of our college. He's currently the medical director of the Accident and Healthcare Urgent Care Clinic in Tauranga in the Bay of Plenty. And Rob and I got to talking about his years of experience and the things that he has learnt over the years, the little gems, the little game changers that have improved his practice, and how we can he's keen to share those with the community. So we came up with an idea of doing about 10 of these little points, and we'll release them over the coming months, a couple at a time. And so today we're going to start with the first two. So welcome, Rob, to our podcast, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Guy. It's certainly a pleasure to be here. I must admit, I'm a little bit anxious knowing that your podcast is now heard in over 55 countries around the world. And I must admit that it's a pleasure welcoming you aboard here in Tauranga, and it's been a pleasure working with you over this past year.
Well, thank you. I enjoy working over here. And certainly I've seen firsthand your approach to urgent care and your knowledge of urgent care. So we decided we'd start with the topic of isolated rib fractures in the elderly. And you've got a case and a few learning points around this to talk about.
Thanks, Guy. We'll just dig right into a case regarding a 76-year-old ex-fireman who stumbled from a standing position onto a curb, and he injured his left lateral chest. There was nothing particularly interesting about his fall. There was no loss of consciousness, no syncope. He'd had no palpitations or chest pain or headache leading up to this fall. He simply stumbled and fell over. I've seen it at hospital, and there he was told that he had two, possibly three broken ribs and no other injury. So I guess it looks like he was discharged home with a script for some paracetamol and some ibuprofen. And unfortunately, over the next 2 to 3 days, he developed, well, you can guess it, fever, chills, increasing shortness of breath. He did have a background of mild COPD and was a smoker. When he came to our urgent care center, we noted him to be pale, tachypneic. He had a respiratory rate of around 24 with a normal blood pressure and a slightly elevated pulse at 105. And a temperature of 38.5 degrees. There was pain on inspiration. He had some splinting type respirations, and he had left lower lobe pneumonia on exam. So he was transferred back to hospital where he spent 7 days on intravenous antibiotics, received some physiotherapy, and was under the pain service for control of his obvious pain. So Guy, I thought this was an important topic for a number of reasons. First of all, isolated rib fractures in the elderly are common. They're rapidly increasing in frequency, and as we'll find out, they can cause significant morbidity and even mortality. Our elderly population is increasing. They are more independent and leading active lifestyles, and as a consequence, they're falling more often. And it's interesting that low velocity falls from a standing height, account for about 50% of isolated rib fractures in the elderly. Isolated rib fractures account for about 12% of all fractures in this group. And it's predicted, of course, that the number of elderly people admitted to hospital due to rib fractures will double in the next 30 years. So the elderly patient with an isolated rib fracture suffers significant morbidity, some say 38%, and mortality 8% overall. The elderly with greater than 3 rib fractures has a 31% chance of pneumonia and about a 19% chance of mortality. And an interesting statistic that I recently learned about was that for each additional rib fracture in patients over 65, the risk of pneumonia increases by 25% and the risk of mortality increases by nearly 20%. So as you can see, there's a need for proper and aggressive management of this patient group, and I think it's imperative.
So in urgent care, we see a lot of injuries, particularly in New Zealand. We're kind of the first port of call for people who've had falls and injuries who don't necessarily require an emergency department. So managing these people in urgent care or working these people up in urgent care, what should we be doing to reduce this burden?
Well, as mentioned, there is this significantly high morbidity and mortality associated with isolated rib fractures in the elderly. And the majority of these complications are, of course, related to chest wall pain and hypoventilation. And really, I think that the treatment, especially in the multi-rib fracture patient, requires a multidisciplinary approach. The pain can be so severe that it needs to involve the services of an acute pain service. I think respiratory therapy needs to be involved with these patients, and physiotherapy to help increase the patient's mobility while they recover is also important, and even a dietitian to improve nutritional support. And when you talk about pain control, yes, it's certainly fine to try the patient on oral medication, but of course you've got to choose your agent wisely. We've recently heard podcasts on your program, you know, discussing the perils of tramadol. We hear podcasts about the use of codeine, and really we shouldn't go down that path either. So our choices are, apart from morphine and paracetamol and their typical non-steroidals, which again should be used for caution in this age group, are becoming limited. So this is where regional anesthesia in the form of epidural infusions, paravertebral blocks, intercostal nerve blocks, are really helpful for the elderly patient with multiple rib fractures. And of these, the epidural infusion appears to be the most effective in that it decreases the incidence of pneumonia, results in better pain scores, and it decreases mortality.
So how do you go about arranging these? You're not doing them yourself.
Well, this is my point, I guess, is that when I see an elderly patient with multiple rib fractures, I'm not going to be managing that patient in the community. I'm going to be picking up the telephone, and I'm going to be quite adamant that they be seen in a hospital setting, not only for the purposes of adequate pain control, but also to see if there's any measures that might improve pulmonary volume expansion. There's a high incidence of hypoventilation in these patients, and they should be encouraged to have incentive spirometry, deep breathing exercises, etc.
And which specialty would you speak to?
I think in this situation, medicine would probably be my choice. I think they have a good working relationship with anesthesia, and I think that they recognize the complications of this particular age group very well, and have a good working relationship with those working in care of the elderly.
And imaging-wise, chest x-rays are not always definitive diagnostically.
Chest x-rays can miss up to 50% of rib fractures.
So would you refer somebody who has clinically got multiple rib fractures, even if the x-ray is normal,
if I was sufficiently worried and the patient was elderly, had any underlying comorbidities, I would certainly consider that. So I think in summary, rib fractures in a young person, well, young, fit, they're kind of more of a nuisance injury. And yes, they do require pain relief and advice that, look, it's going to take 3 weeks to heal. Come back and see me if you're developing any fever, shortness of breath. That's the standard advice. But they should be viewed as serious and life-threatening in the elderly, particularly if there's multiple rib fractures. And serious consideration should be given to hospital admission with strict attention to pain control, respiratory care, and proper discharge planning.
And the logic being that if you get on top of it before the complication develops, you're less likely to go on and develop that pneumonia and the subsequent issues rather than the person being sent home and a week later presenting like your fireman there unwell.
Absolutely, and that's why we chose that case, is just to highlight the fact that the pain control was probably not properly addressed or wasn't expected to be as severe as it was. And if we can just put out the message to our urgent care colleagues that this particular group is at high risk of morbidity.
I'm interested, you said you insist on it. Have you had any pushback in trying to discuss these cases with the hospital? Is it, and what would be your fallback if you got a negative?
I think I'd quote some of the statistics that I just let your shared with your listeners. And many times we are dealing with a fairly junior house staff who, again, hear the idea or might have been taught the concept that rib fractures are just a nuisance injury. But I probably would quote some of the statistics that we've learned about today.
And via the show notes, and we'll discuss it at the end, you have some links that we'll be able to share where people can get those statistics.
Absolutely.
Read some of the papers. But it usually goes a long way if you can quote numbers to people and put the whole thing in perspective and say, these are the numbers, this person needs to be admitted. But if you're still concerned, then talking to the emergency department might be the next step.
And that is certainly what we would do and locally in Tauranga. You know, if there was any resistance, we'd be speaking with our emergency room colleagues, and who are, I think, very reasonable and would take this patient who were concerned.
In 34 years of practice, it's inevitable that mistakes will happen, and your next thing you want to talk about is the failing up and improving, failing better, is failing up and failing better, because we will make mistakes, won't we? But it's how we deal with them that is important.
That's right, Guy, and thanks very much for having me discuss this topic. And first of all, I'd like to give credit where credit is due. This is from episode 63, EM Cases with Dr. Sarah Gray, where much of the following information is coming from, and I don't want to take any credit for what I'm about to say, except I've taken some of the things that she's taught me and related it to my practice, and I'd like to share those with you. Do you have a medical mistake that haunts you?
I can think of a few.
Yeah, I know I do. And in fact, when you've been doing this job for as long as we have, you're bound to have a few. And I can remember the first mistake or failure, if you like, that happened not long after my training. And I can remember the shame and the anxiety and the lack of sleep and some of the reclusive behavior that I demonstrated. And I think if you asked my wife, she'd probably say I was kind of hard to live with around that time. And I began to kind of feel like perhaps a bit of an imposter. And I've just recently heard about this imposter syndrome. I think I felt a bit like that at the time. There's three ways to deal with a mistake or a failure. And the first one is choosing not to deal with it and just suffer in silence. And I think that's what I did after this mistake, is I lived in what seemed like perpetual doubt. And Guy, it was quite a lonely feeling. I began practicing defensive medicine. I was ordering a lot of unnecessary tests, which didn't do my patients any good. And somehow I managed to emerge from it, but it took a long time. Another way that I've seen my colleagues deal with a mistake or a failure is that they would bury their head in the sand. They'd kind of blow it off, and as Dr. Sarah Gray mentions in her podcast, these people became hardened and uncaring and ruthless, and I've seen the cynicism that can sometimes exist in our colleagues when they're burnt out and may have had this sort of failure affect them adversely. But again, in this podcast, and I wish there was this type of podcast around when I first started medicine, there is a better way to deal with failure and mistake. And I only wish I'd listened to Sarah Gray 35 years ago. But we can we can learn from the fail, and that's called failing up. And this is a way of learning from a mistake, and it makes you more accountable, it makes you more compassionate, and in the end, I think it makes you more competent as a doctor. Sarah Gray said, look, when we sweep our failures under the rug, we miss an opportunity to heal, to learn, to grow, and to teach people about them more effectively. It's important for people to feel they are not alone. And so she talks about a few steps in order to fail up. And one of the first steps is just to accept that you're going to fail. And if you accept that and know it's coming, it'll make it easier to recover. The second step is to break the silence, and it's about talking about your failure. And to talk about your failure is not a sign of weakness. It's actually a sign of courage. And one of the things she talked about was finding yourself a failure friend. And Guy, in front of 55 countries, listeners around the world, I'm going to propose to you on air. And I'm going to ask you, Dr. Melrose, will you be my failure friend?
I will.
Well, what that means is that when I fail, and I probably will fail soon, hopefully not tonight for my next shift, but that I can come to you, someone who won't judge me, someone who I know is capable of empathy, and I can say how I'm feeling. I can talk to you about what's happened, and I know that you'll be there to listen to me. And maybe not fix things, but just to say, hey, Rob, I've walked in your shoes. I feel your pain. I know what it's like to make a mistake. What do you think of that?
I think it's important that that person has walked the same walk as you. And that's the difficulty of our job, is that it's such a broad scope. We can't know everything. And there is a lot of pathology that's hidden. So inevitably we'll miss things. And those of us who are working understand that, and so if somebody makes a mistake, it's easier to be able to see that could have been me, and so that peer support is important.
Absolutely, and I think that the final step is basically to teach from your mistake, and not just about the medical aspects of your mistake, but also the coping strategies that you use to get through and get over this mistake. Learn and teach about your mistake from a position of acceptance and self-care. And I can remember the first time I missed a Lisfranc fracture. I felt terrible. But I remembered that the best way to deal with this was to actually teach it. And I've gone out of my way to teach the younger registrars and doctors in this clinic about Lisfranc fractures and what they are, how not to miss them. And I must admit, they're everywhere. I've seen 3 Lisfranc fractures in the last 3 months. And while I will probably go on and miss another one, at least I have taught my colleagues the best I can to be wary. So I think what I wanted to conclude by saying is that don't let your mistakes drag you down. Use them as a springboard towards self-growth.
Yeah, I think there's a danger, isn't it, that we go through medical school having been successful at school, and you've got the highest grades and you get into the medical school. So there's this element of we should be perfect, or we should be the best, and that's not necessarily a good place to be in. You've got to acknowledge that you might make mistakes. But once you've made a mistake, how you react to it is important. And I like what you've said about sharing it, because a problem shared is a problem halved, and then teaching it, because the best way to learn something is to teach it, because it shows an understanding. And certainly the cases that I've learned the most from have been the ones that I struggled with at the start, and then you find yourself on the flip side seeing it sooner and managing it better the next time, and it's immensely satisfying. Carrying that guilt of missing something isn't easy, but when you know somebody else has done it, it definitely feels, you feel less of a failure, you feel less of a less of an idiot, and it's important. And I think it, particularly if you one of the benefits of urgent care is that we are working as a group. There's very few clinics I know where you're on your own, unlike general practice where you're behind a closed door. It's a much more social specialty, isn't it? So you've always got people to share and speak to and run things off and bounce ideas off. And
absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more. And thanks so much for having me.
No, thank you for sharing those tips. And that's the first of two of 10. And we will have more in the future of your wise words from 34 years on the front line of medicine. So thank you, Rob, and we'll see you again soon.
Thanks, Guy.
My thanks to Rob for talking to the podcast. He'll be back to share more of his lessons learned from 30-odd years of practice in future podcasts. In the meantime, if you're on Facebook, pop over to Urgent Care Updates with Dr. Rob, where he shares articles, blogs, papers, and podcasts relevant to urgent care practice. The link is in the show notes, alongside a link to the EM podcast on failing up that he mentioned, and a blog post discussing rib fractures in the elderly. If you have any comments, questions, corrections, or suggestions, please email podcast@rnzcuc.org.nz. Now we'll be back next week with another podcast. I look forward to seeing you all then, but for now, thanks for listening.